I'm John Kroll. Coming up on No Limits, we will talk about access and accountability in government. This year marks the 40th anniversary of one of the seminal moments in American history, the publication of the Pentagon Papers. That moment continues to shape the way Americans view their government and remains a flashpoint, particularly in the debate over the way journalists and other concerned citizens should deal with public officials and public policy. The furor over the WikiLeaks story is but the latest skirmish in what has been a long struggle. We are fortunate to have as our guest today the man who lit the fire and released the Pentagon Papers, Dr. Daniel Ellsberg, as well as Eric Bradner, the State House Bureau Chief for the Evansville Courier and Press, and the President of the Indiana Professional Chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists, and Jerry Linowska, a Ball State University professor and a board member of the Indiana Coalition for Open Government. We will talk about how hard it is to get information from government officials and why it matters with these guests and with you. You can join the conversation by calling us toll-free at 1-866-476-3881, sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending questions or comments via Facebook and Twitter at WFYI. First, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We're talking today about the issues of access and accountability in government. We're fortunate to have as our guests right now Eric Bradner, who is the State House Bureau Chief for the Evansville Courier and Press, and the new board president for the Indiana Professional Chapter, the Society of Professional Journalists. That's an awful lot to get out in one breath. Also, Eric, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. And Jerry Linowska, who is a Ball State University faculty member and is a board member for the Indiana Coalition for Open Government. Jerry, good to have you on the program.
Thank you very much.
We hope to be joined soon by Dr. Daniel Ellsberg of Pentagon Papers fame. And I should say at the beginning of the program, in the interest of full disclosure, since we're talking about all of this, Jerry and Eric and I are all board members for the Indiana Professional Chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists. So just so the audience knows that we work together and know each other. I'd like to start, I think, Jerry, by asking you about the genesis of ICOG, why there was a perceived need for something like the Indiana Coalition for Open Government. Because I think that speaks at the heart of the sort of challenge we continue to face with these issues.
Yeah, sure. I can walk you through the history of that. ICOG, and I would like to pitch our website and talk about a few resources that listeners might be interested
plug
in.
Plug away.
It is www.indianacog.org, and I'll mention a few of the resources there. Maybe later in the program, but there's some helpful things that citizens can use. And citizens are really the heart of what ICOG is all about. And I'm throwing around the term ICOG as if everyone knows what that is. The formal name is Indiana Coalition for Open Government. We just know ourselves as ICOG. And it spun out of the Society of Professional Journalists, actually, out of the thinking that access to government and the need for oversight of government is not just a journalist's interest. Certainly the laws that we have to open government aren't written specifically for journalists. And so there was a feeling by the board at the time that there was a need to get more citizen involvement in these issues of advocacy for openness. And so ICOG was established with that in mind as a coalition of not just press organizations, SPJ and so forth, but also of citizens, ordinary citizens and citizens organizations. We had a number of coalition affiliates at the time that are still sort of loosely affiliated with the organization, ranging from Hoosier Environmental Council to Common Cause of Indiana. And so it's really about a broad-based movement to promote open government, not just for journalists, but for citizens as a whole.
How many groups total are involved in ICOG?
Well, involved is a tricky word, but we had, I think, 11 or 12 organizations who were sort of charter affiliates. And they're, the organization pretty much exists virtually, and we do programs now and again. The organizations that we still list as affiliates are pretty much involved as sort of fellow travelers who are interested in the issue of the same issues we are, which is having access to government meetings and records.
Eric Bradner, could you talk a little bit, since you Jerry and I, in some ways, are both recovering professional journalists now, having been out of sort of daily coverage, but you deal with covering government and politicians on a daily basis. How difficult is it to get access to information and or records? How skeptical, frankly, should we be of what public officials do?
Sure. In many cases, it's actually not that difficult, and I think that's part of the Pentagon Papers' legacy. Government officials now know that journalists have some fairly strong tools for getting the information that we need, and often simply the threat of Freedom of Information Act request or something along those lines is enough to get what we're asking for without necessarily needing to take advantage of legal tools. There seem to be a couple of key questions right now that we see in Indiana in terms of what sort of information is available. One is what types of electronic communications journalists should have access to under open records laws. And another is how much of the sausage-making process we should be able to see when there's documentation of it. So there are three prime examples in Indiana right now. One is the so-called Rakita Report, which is a 200-plus page investigation put together under Indiana's previous Secretary of State, Todd Rakita, looking into residency issues related to the current Secretary of State, Charlie White. Todd Rakita chose not to release that to the public while he was in office. And for the first few months of his tenure, Charlie White didn't release it either. He has since done so, but not under any sort of legal requirement to do so. The other two examples deal with the Daniels administration. There's the case involving IBM and Governor Mitch Daniels' $1.3 billion effort to privatize the state's welfare delivery system. There are 900-plus pages of internal documents and emails that the Daniels administration has been forced by court to give up to IBM related to a lawsuit. The two are suing each other, but those documents have not been made public. So those are emails. Another example of emails is the IURC, Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission, situation involving Duke Energy that the Indianapolis Star has reported so heavily on in the last few months. So those are illustrations of these two key questions. What types of electronic communications should journalists have access to? And what kinds of, how much depth should we get to dig into in terms of decisions that are being made?
We are joined now by Dr. Daniel Ellsberg, who is calling from his home in California. Dr. Ellsberg.
Hello.
Welcome to the program. I'm John Krall. You are on the air with Jerry Linoska, who's a faculty member for Ball State University and a board member of the Indiana Coalition for Open Government, and Eric Bradner, who is the State House Bureau Chief for the Evansville Courier and Press and the president of the Indiana Professional Chapter of the Society for Professional Journalists. Obviously, the hook, as it were, for this program, and we're talking about issues of access and accountability in government, is that we're celebrating the anniversary or marking the anniversary of the publication of the Pentagon Papers and the PBS documentary on that epic in American history, The Most Dangerous Man in America. What I'd like to ask you about is, what do you think the lasting legacy or influence of the publication of the Pentagon Papers is in terms of opening up government?
Well, governments of all kinds don't cooperate in being opened up very much. They're not very happy about it, and President Obama is actually taking unprecedented steps to close it down from public view. And he's had an absolutely unprecedented number of prosecutions now against whistleblowers. Mine was the first 40 years ago, using the Espionage Act as if it were a British-type Official Secrets Act that criminalized the disclosure of all classified information. That was the first time it had been used for that purpose. It was only used twice after that before Obama. for a total of three. President Obama has brought five such prosecutions, almost twice as much as all previous presidents put together. And with if he goes after Julian Assange, which seems to be happening, that will be six. So that, along with his continuing George W. Bush's use of the state secrets privilege to stop legal investigation, really, in the courts of such things as torture and detention policies or Guantanamo or the rendition, all of that means that it's possibly as secretive as any administration has ever been in history, and that means possibly even more than George W. Bush. So in terms of the current legacy, it's not looking good. The if you say what lasting effect did it have on our appreciation, well, again, it's hard to say lasting, but for quite a while, there was realization that the Pentagon Papers, followed by Watergate in domestic matters, demonstrated I.F. Stone's, the journalist I.F. Stone's dictum, all government officials lie, and nothing they say is to be believed. And that definitely starts with the president and his subordinates. It doesn't mean that everything they say is a lie, but it does mean that anything they say could be a lie. And a great deal of it, while not being, let's say, strictly a lie, is misleading, misdirection, in kind of a magician's term, distracting attention from dangerous questions or investigations. And it does, I think, it should have led Congress and the press and the public to constantly be asking the question when they hear an announcement of what our policy is from the president and what, or his appointees, or what the reasons for it are, what the considerations are. They should really always be asking, what's the real policy? What were the considerations that really were brought to bear on this? On the assumption that we're never, ever hearing the whole story there, and very often hearing a very misleading story. And if we want to have any informed influence on policy, we really depend on investigation, probing behind those statements, not taking them as the last word. That doesn't mean they should be ignored, statements, but that it does mean that if the press is simply being a stenographer, sort of reporting on what government officials say, and there are journalists who see that as their preeminent job, or at least as a major part of their job, just to pass on what officials say they're doing or why they're doing it and what the prospects are, they're just being part of the executive branch, public affairs division, kind of a propaganda advance. And that what the First Amendment really was meant to do was to encourage them to look behind that and look for other sources of evidence, including subordinates in the middle levels of the bureaucracy who might be willing to give a fuller picture and tell us what the alternatives to the current policy were and why they were pressed and what dangers people might see about the current policy from within the administration. If they did that, they'd be serving the purposes, I think, of the First Amendment very much better than they are. Likewise, Congress has in recent years, 10 years really, abandoned, I would say, its role of investigating, using its subpoena powers and really investigating government policy. They do that when the party controlling Congress has the same party in the presidency, but also to a surprising degree even when they do differ. When Congress was in the hands of Democrats after 2006, they did not use that power with respect to Bush. And Obama has eschewed investigating the crimes of the Bush administration. So they're not doing their job, I would say. But the lesson of the Pentagon Papers is that's what the job is. It needs to be done.
We are talking about access and accountability in government, and we are fortunate to have as our guest Dr. Daniel Ellsberg, who's calling from his home in California, Eric Bradner, who is the State House Bureau Chief for the Evansville Courier and Press.
Excuse me, I'm not hearing you too well.
And the president of the Indiana Professional Chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists, Jerry Linoska, who is a board member for the Indiana Coalition for Open Government and a Ball State University faculty member. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We're talking about access and accountability in government. Our guests are Dr. Daniel Ellsberg, Eric Bradner of the Evansville Courier and Press, and the Society of Professional Journalists, Jerry Linoska of the Indiana Coalition for Open Government, and a Ball State University faculty member. I'd like to invite our listeners to join the program by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Mike, how are you doing today?
I'm good, thank you, Mr. Ellsberg. You've always been, I've always admired your work with our, a couple comments. Question is with what the Supreme Court in the first passed with corporate, outside corporate money, foreign corporate money being able to be into any campaign and not being able to be disclosed on how much and what, where it's put. Number two, what about WikiLeaks? Number three, what about the Koch brothers with Wisconsin? How does that fit play with Daniels and maybe a possible Republican strategy from Republican governors across the United States where you're getting big corporate interest trying to set the stage? I mean, obviously they're setting the stage, but those are my points or thoughts.
Thank you very much. We will try to take them briefly. Thanks for the call, Mike.
Bye.
Okay. Did you want me to respond?
Yes, Dr. Ellsberg, if you could start first.
Okay, to take those in reverse order, I really don't know much about the policy you're describing of the Koch brothers. I should know more. I know there's been some good journalism on that. But I'm not really up on it. It ties in with your first question about the Supreme Court. And there, something that puzzles me is how a decision that was based, as I understand it, largely on, somewhat at least, on the rights of corporations as persons to speak, or to, and that money is a form of speech, and that they can't be restrained from what they're giving. There are questions to be raised, of course, there about the import of regarding corporations as persons in that respect. But what I was saying puzzles me is how that seems to go along with allowing them to be secretive about their contributions. It would seem that the public interest is served here. It might be served by allowing organizations, and that includes not only corporations, but nonprofit organizations of some sort, or unions, and specifically, and others, to speak, that is, to give money. But to do it secretly and without disclosing the donors, it does seem that our democracy would be served by allowing people to know where candidates and where campaigns are getting their money. I say I don't really fully understand how those go together. On WikiLeaks, I've been a great supporter of WikiLeaks, although not to say that they're perfect or that everything they do is beyond criticism. Nothing they do is beyond criticism or anything else. But specifically, I think some of the early disclosures on Afghanistan failed adequately to redact names of informants, even though a lot of names were redacted, but some did get through, and that was potentially dangerous. That, fortunately, seems to have resulted in no harm to any individuals, according to the Pentagon. It could have harmed, but it didn't, as far as we know. Whereas the process that was being exposed by those disclosures are operations in Afghanistan and later in Iraq, and the video, for example, of the attack by the Apache helicopter on a number of civilians. All of those reported harm to individuals that is going on day by day and threatens to continue indefinitely, really. So I think that the fix we're in the world, it isn't just one fix, the multiple pits we're in of policy in the Middle East and in climate and in the financial meltdown and all of those things, not one of those resulted, I would say, from a failure of the secrecy system. Not one of them resulted or was even contributed to by too many leaks, or for that matter, any leaks or any breach in secrecy, that secrets weren't being protected. On the contrary, in every case, there was a question of the government or the financial institutions, which are in turn being protected by the government now, having concealed information, defrauded, basically, kept secrets that should not have been kept from the public, and were able to lie with impunity and deceive us on the basis of that. And the import of that, I would say, is that we need a lot more whistleblowing, a lot more leaks, not fewer. And the process that I described earlier of the President Obama's Department of Justice bringing an unprecedented number of prosecutions now for what really was whistleblowing, what they can't claim in the slightest harmed the United States, on the contrary, brought out waste in the case of Thomas Drake, who's about to be prosecuted, and other examples I could give, and the WikiLeaks case, as I say, did not result in harm, so far has been reported, and did bring to bear information that could possibly shorten the war and save lives. So I think the administration is going in the wrong direction there in these prosecutions, and has not yet shown a will to investigate, which may not come until there's much more whistleblowing, much more revelation by insiders to light a fire under the Congress and force them to investigate and the administration. But meanwhile, I should have mentioned, I think that WikiLeaks' original release didn't take sufficient care in redacting names that should not have been put out, but they did improve their performance very strikingly in later releases. And I think that problem did not arise in the Iraq war logs that were released later, so far as I know. And in the case of the large number of State Department cables that were made available to the press, WikiLeaks has only published those cables, with a few exceptions, that the newspapers involved with their large staffs and their experience have chosen to put out and to that they found newsworthy. And the result there is that so far they've only published 2%, less than 2% of the 250,000 cables they have. So it's the opposite of indiscriminate, which is a word very commonly used in that, and I think wrongly used. If anything, one could question whether enough has been put out yet, but certainly not too much.
We are talking about access and accountability in government, and we're fortunate to have as our guest Dr. Daniel Ellsberg, Jerry Linowska of ICOG, and Eric Bradner of the Society of Professional Journalists. I think I'd like to take it around the horn here, ask, are there any bits of information, documents or whatever, that government ought to be allowed to keep secret, assuming that, you know, that there is, the burden should be on them to demonstrate that it should be kept secret? What things is it appropriate, do you think it's justifiable for government to keep secret?
There's a lot, especially for some limited period. There's very little, I think. I would start by saying that the line should not be drawn between the executive branch and Congress as a whole. I think there's very little that, if anything, that deserves to be kept entirely from anybody in Congress. And that actually is done quite a bit. Even the oversight committees that, in theory, have access to everything in the executive branch are constantly complaining after the fact that they were not informed of things that have somehow come out or been leaked or even been announced by the administration. And that shouldn't happen. But there are things that certainly deserve secrecy for some limited period of time. And specifically, a great deal of our communications intelligence does have a law, a narrow law, which forbids, criminalizes the release of that information, occasionally breached, and often and sometimes breached by the administration when it shouldn't be. For example, actually that kept secret the NSA secret wiretaps, the warrantless wiretaps, which were covered by that law, and yet the it didn't so far lead to any prosecutions, but could have. And that was a case, I think, where the information should have been made available, as it eventually was, to the New York Times, for which they got a Pulitzer Prize. But in many other cases, for example, the fact that we had a mole within the communications apparatus of Al-Qaeda, which was confirmed wrongly, I would say, by Condoleezza Rice, or in particular, the name of Valerie Plame, a CIA covert operator, again covered by a narrow law forbidding the release of the names of clandestine operators, that should not have been released by Karl Rove or Scooter Libby or Armitage or Cheney, all of whom collaborated in doing that for narrow domestic reasons, to punish her husband, Joe Wilson, for having told the truth about government lies, about the connection of Saddam Hussein, his search for uranium, supposedly, in Niger, which was based, by the way, on a forged document, which has never been adequately investigated. We've never found out where that forgery came from. That would be a good subject for a leak, by the way. So here are things that should not have been put out. I would not have put them out. I don't know anybody who would have deliberately done that, although it was done deliberately for kind of frivolous reasons.
Jerry Linowska, are the documents or is there information that the government ought to be able to conceal?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think, and I'm very active in the community of people who advocate, for broad public access. So I start from a presumption that of openness and ask for it and let the government. You said a very important phrase, John, which is burden of proof. Not only does the government have the obligation in a moral sense to show why it should be able to keep certain records confidential when it chooses to do so, but it has a statutorily required to do that. Both the federal government and the state government are required to justify their decisions to disclose. But that said, there are statutory exemptions for certain things, law enforcement records, even domestic law enforcement. Looking at the text of the FOIA, there are, obviously personnel and medical files that the government might have on individuals. Those things, you can make a rationale that those things should not be disclosed to anyone who just wants to paw through those records. So most advocates would tend to agree that there are things that can be reasonably kept secret, but the government does have a strong burden to prove why and justify its ability to do that under statute.
Eric Bradner.
Sure. I think Jerry's on the right track, especially on the state level where I work. There are obviously no national security concerns, but there are law enforcement issues, domestic law enforcement, medical situations that the government probably can keep secret. Another situation where you see the state government keep some things under wraps is the Indiana Economic Development Corporation, which is sort of a quasi-governmental state agency that negotiates with businesses that are considering moving into Indiana. The IEDC offers incentives, and many of these ultimately become public, but businesses are required to share some information with them that these businesses view as secrets that they need to keep in order to remain competitive with other businesses in their same line of work. So those types of things it probably should stay under wraps, at least to some extent, but the burden of proof does lie with government.
Well, and I'm curious because I think one of the areas we're kind of dancing around here, and we've gotten a couple of email questions, one of which sort of relates to this, is the intersection really of public and private, particularly since we're now embracing more public-private partnerships, and one of the concerns about those historically has been that they blur lines of accountability and make it harder for you to know exactly what's going on. There's actually an allusion, Dr. Ellsberg, to that in the documentary about you, The Most Dangerous Man in America, and the establishment of the RAND Corporation, the fact that it was put out on the West Coast in part to avoid the kind of scrutiny that would come with being in the center of government. We see that at all levels of government. Can we talk a little bit about what that does to the process and what it does to people's faith in their government? Dr. Ellsberg, could you go first?
Well, I think the in the movie, referring to the putting RAND on Muscle Beach in Santa Monica,
mm-hmm.
the side of the ocean, or the other side of the continent, rather, from mm-hmm. The Pentagon, was not so much, I don't believe, initially to avoid accountability as to prevent RAND, R&D, R, Research and Development, the acronym,
mm-hmm.
from being simply a staff part of the Pentagon, being relied on for day-to-day kind of staff work, and help it be freer to pursue its own leads in long-term research of various kinds. But there has been, since my day, and really quite recently, an enormous explosion of reliance on outside contractors for all kinds of things that were initially thought of as the essence of government work, including a lot of intelligence analysis and collection. And I've heard that the bulk of the intelligence budget goes actually to private contractors at this point. That's almost hard to believe, and perhaps I'm wrong, but I do recall seeing that reported. There's no question that an enormous amount of it does go. And that does raise questions of accountability, because it's even less possible to get at what those private contractors are doing for the government than it is in the government, which is hard enough. I would differ in emphasis a little bit from what I heard from several of the commentators just now on about this burden of proof being on the government to justify keeping secrets. The law might be written that way, or in principle. In practice, I think burden of proof to whom? To whom does the government really have to justify its decisions to keep something secret? In theory, courts can look over that. There's very little monitoring, I think, of that process. And in general, courts, with a few exceptions, have tended to defer far more than they should to the government's judgment, the executive branch's judgment as to what should be secret. For example, in the state secrets privilege, in theory, judges have a right to look at these alleged secrets and decide for themselves whether they justify dropping a case. In practice, most judges have chosen simply to say, if you say it's secret, that's it. And I would say, I'm sure there are responsibilities there. A very strong example of that would be the Apache helicopter assault on the civilians, or on, let's say, civilian clothes people, two of whom were Reuters employees, were shot down in Iraq from a helicopter. Reuters tried to get that film when they shot from the helicopter when they learned of its existence for 2 years by Freedom of Information Act, and were simply refused. Moreover, by the way, it seems that one Washington Post reporter certainly had access to that film. He wrote about it in a book and was believed by, according to the chat logs with Bradley Manning, to actually possess a copy, but he didn't put that out or give it to Reuters. So the only way it could have gotten out finally was that it was given to WikiLeaks outside the FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act process. Well, that certainly, there's a case where we have a chance now to go back and take another look at that process and say, who decided that that should be classified or that the public shouldn't see that? The reasons for their not wanting the public to see it are obvious enough. It does raise the question of just how often unarmed civilians are shot down from the air, as the Iraqis are constantly claiming, and we tend to deny. In other words, is that an isolated instance? There's a good deal of testimony that it's not. So that was something the public needed to hear. There would be a case where you really could examine. We have the information now, finally, because it was leaked, or in cases where stuff does get put out by FOIA eventually after appeals in some cases. And you can always ask, who made the judgment and what were the criteria that kept this secret earlier, and should this ever have been classified? Well, the truth is, the government really doesn't have to justify that effectively to almost anybody. And in the helicopter case, no such investigation has been held, as far as I know.
We are talking about access and accountability in government with our guests, Eric Bradner, Jerry Linowska, and Dr. Daniel Ellsberg. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking about access and accountability in government. We're fortunate to have as our guest Dr. Daniel Ellsberg, the Pentagon Papers fame, Eric Bradner, who is the State House Bureau Chief for the Evansville Courier and Press, and president of the Indiana Society of Professional Journalists. That's a mouthful. Jerry Linowska, you guys all have long titles, who is a board member for the Indiana Coalition for Open Government and a Ball State University faculty member. I'd like to talk about this, bring this into a closer focus at the state level. Eric, you referenced at the top of the program the breakdown between FSSA and IBM and how some of the details there, the records, have not been opened up to the public, even though they're part of litigation, and it's litigation that's likely to cost the taxpayers of the state some money.
Right. Yeah, there were about 900 pages of documents. These are emails between the governor and the governor's staff and IBM, and among the governor's staff related to this deal, this privatization deal. And IBM has successfully received they sued to get those documents, and they got a judge to force the state to hand them over. However, they've not been made public, and there's no point at which we expect them to be right now. So this is a deal that is obviously going to cost the taxpayers a lot of money. It has so far through payments the state has made to IBM, as well as 22 other contractors, and it will in the future in court costs. So there's a very legitimate question about whether these should be kept secret, and so far the state is doing that. Now, if Mitch Daniels runs for president, it's hard to imagine that they would remain that way. But it's an important question.
Jerry Linowska, is this an issue that ICOG focuses on, this intersection of the public and the private, and the fact that in these partnerships there does seem to be a tendency to try to shift information around so that it's just harder for the public to know what's going on?
It is a real concern that the coalition has been keeping an eye on for a number of years. And the state law doesn't really discuss this issue very much when the level of concern that we have when a private contractor takes over an aspect of government and physically takes control of public documents or begins generating documents that were the function being performed by a government agency, those documents would be public. So our state law doesn't really address that particular circumstance very well, and it's one of the flaws in our law. That said, I would like to just say that we do have a pretty good access law in Indiana, and despite the flaws, and despite some of the flaws in the FOIA, there are good tools there that are available to citizens. And just to respond a little bit to what Dr. Ellsberg said regarding burden of proof, I do think that it's important for citizens to know that the law allows them to, gives them the right to put a request in for records and get a very specific response from the government, both at state and federal levels, which says, here you can either have the records that you've asked for or you cannot, and here's why. Specifically at the federal level, agencies are required to tell you if they're not going to give you records, they have to give you a list of what they're not giving you and tell you why on each particular record that's being withheld, why that record's not being released. It's called a Vaughn Index, and it's available to FOIA requesters. So is the FOIA perfect? Certainly not, and that's why we have leakers, and I agree with Dr. Ellsberg that it's important that we have leaks and continue that and maybe have more leaks. But there is a good formal process.
Well, those of us who worked as journalists would have been out of business without them, without
absolutely.
People who leaked information.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's important for access to sort of proceed on two avenues. One is that formal avenue of requesting by statute, and second is that informal avenue by which journalists get information through leaks.
Jerry, real quickly, how would, say I am a concerned citizen or one of our listeners is a concerned citizen, wants to know something about, how do you go about doing a FOIA request? And we probably should not use the acronym
sure.
here for everybody. It's Freedom of Information Act.
Sure.
How do they go about doing that?
Well, there's two things to know. First off, that the Freedom of Information Act is a federal act, and it applies to federal agencies, federal executive agencies. It does not apply to Congress or the courts. Congress was clever enough to exempt itself from complying with that law. And at the state level in Indiana, we have the Indiana Access to Public Records Act. Both sort of work by the same mechanisms. You can put in a request by a letter. Sometimes you can do it in person. Certainly, if you're in the state, you can go to a public agency and walk in the front door and request records during business hours and get them on the spot. I would just like to direct listeners to a resource on both of those levels. At our website, indianacog.org, on the very left, upper left-hand corner of our homepage is a link that says "Need a Public Record," and if you click that, you will get an interface that allows you to fill out information about the agency that you're interested in getting records from, the type of records that you would like, and click a button. It will generate a letter with all the formalistic legal language that you would like to have in a public records request, and you can print that out and send it or bring it with you when you go into a public office. Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, which has a website at rcfp.org, has a similar resource for federal requests under the FOIA. So those are good resources, not just for journalists, by the way, but for citizens who should be involved in this as well.
We've gotten an email question from a listener that I think speaks to one of the themes we have been discussing is how concealing information and frankly, lying to people, in effect, disenfranchises and distances people from their government. This comes from Sarah Johnson and says, I've always followed news and politics, but I've been especially aware of events this spring, and I took the opportunity to venture into local politics and the Indiana State Capitol building. This was a daunting experience as an unindoctrinated citizen, going through security, trying to find my way around the building, and sending notes to senators in an attempt to persuade them briefly and in passing in a hallway. I am still amazed at how much business is carried out in the halls of that building. That setting presents a divide between citizen and politician, which cannot foster an open government. Perhaps more notably to my mind, however, was the disregard with which a citizen's concerns were dismissed and the arrogance with which Indiana senators queried petitioners. The divide between the public and government, despite the myth of U.S. grassroots politics and such arrogance among legislators, make me doubtful that government will ever be fully responsive to the public. This is especially evident for those of us who are less represented in the legislature and is exacerbated at a federal level. Dr. Ellsberg, you've spoken eloquently about how citizens can empower themselves in dealing with government. What sort of advice would you give someone like Sarah Johnson?
Well, her experience, I think, was opened a reality to her, which is that, now, my experience is mainly in the executive branch, I should say, rather than in the legislature, either at the state or federal level. But the people in the executive branch in particular don't really believe that the public has a legitimate or useful role to play in the making of policy. They recognize that the Constitution somehow, you know, gives them some formal role here somehow. But they really think of it would be much better if they, the philosopher kings here, who are responsive mainly to large donors, would be free to satisfy their donors and get reelected in that fashion by getting enough donations to assure that they will swamp the airways with the help of corporate money, as was suggested in the earlier comments. I'm of course, paraphrasing here. They don't put it quite in that fashion. But the notion that small donors or people who don't donate at all but merely vote or perhaps don't even vote but people who vote, let's say, should really have a valuable voice to be heard, or is not much in their consciousness. It's just something they put up with formally. And that means, I think, by the way, that we need every avenue of influence that we can in influencing. And that means, in particular, I think we have probably more influence with Congress than we do with the executive branch, generally. The fact that she was able to see these senators at all, even if they brushed her off, is quite a contrast from trying to walk the halls of the Pentagon, let's say, or try to get into the White House, which is obviously a joke. But the State Department, any of those places, they wouldn't get in to see any of those people. The possibility for really any kind of direct influence is very small. Actually, I used to think, for instance, that letters to the editor, letters to, I thought a long time ago, letters to the editor, letters to congresspersons were a pretty feeble way of influence. I think that was underestimated in the sense that they do take, I am told by people on the Hill, that they do take account a good deal if people really do forcefully present their views to them. But I would think that part of the language of that might well be that not just a simple petition, but an alerting these people that you're prepared to work against them in primaries, something they really do fear, raise primary challenge, help primary challenges to them, and arrange to get them fired if they don't do what the public wants, not just what one person wants, but if they get enough heat on this. It's said on the Hill sometimes, they may not see the light, but they'll feel the heat. And if you bring heat to bear, especially on Congress, and in letters to the editor, express points of view that aren't being expressed in the media, if you can get them in at all. I would even think, by the way, that visitations to local newspapers and radio stations, something that I think is almost never done. I've always thought that that had some promise in trying to bring pressure to bear on them to have adequate coverage. Very specifically there, the Internet allows us now to see what a lot of other newspapers in other towns are saying and have a much broader view of what is available to journalists. And if your local newspaper and radio station isn't covering that, it seems to me it would be possible to challenge them and say, look, here's how this was handled elsewhere. How come it didn't deserve any attention from you? But in other words, there are demonstrations, there is lobbying, public lobbying. So I do applaud your person called in there for taking the effort to go into the halls. A lot more of that can be done. And I think even if they brush you off, the fact that they're hearing that, that may indeed have an influence. Numbers may count here if there's enough of them, in countering the effect of money, which is, no question, a stronger channel of influence.
Eric Bradner, real quickly, you're over at the State House all the time. In about a minute, what would be your three bullet points for Sarah if she wanted to try to influence government and bridge that gap?
Sure. She makes a fascinating observation because walking into the State House as just a regular person who doesn't know how things work over there, it's a different world. It's foreign. And yes, you can pass notes to legislators and ask them to come out and speak with you briefly, and that's generally a good idea, but in a session like the one we just had, it's tough because you've got so many protesters there, and Republicans are convinced that they've won big majorities because these protesters are in the minority. So what I would say is letters count. Write to your legislators. Have your friends do it too, because they tally those. They keep counts of how many people have written for or against an issue, and try not to make those form letters. Try to have something different to say.
But get your argument, I would assume.
Exactly.
It sounds like in that,
yes.
Right in the first sentence rather
right.
than burying it
exactly.
down.
Yeah. Don't worry about writing a very long email. That won't do much good. It's the numbers that matter. The other thing is, yeah, if you can threaten some sort of primary or pose a real threat in an election, if you can organize people to donate money or to work against someone that matters too, because the grassroots are effective on election day, maybe not so much after election day, but leading up to an election, that matters. So those are the two pieces of advice that I would give. Third, focus your energies on legislators who are in influential positions, committee chairs, those who have been around for a long time. Don't spend a heck of a lot of time trying to lobby a freshman.
Dr. Ellsberg, we've got just about 30 seconds left, and we've gotten a question from Norm in Indy about what would be the best single source on the history of the Pentagon Papers. I'm obviously going to do a plug for the documentary about you, The Most Dangerous Man in America, but is there a book or an Internet site you could quickly recommend?
It sound self-serving, but actually, for some reason, the one that comes to mind is my own memoir. It's a memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers. I wish actually there was a good source other than that. John Prados, Prados, has written on the Pentagon Papers quite a bit. You can look that up. But I haven't been too satisfied with other accounts. But mine, on which the movie is based, by the way, does go into it in more detail than anybody else.
We have been talking about access and accountability in government. We've been fortunate to have as our guest Dr. Daniel Ellsberg, calling from his home in California. Dr. Ellsberg, thank you for joining us for this hour. It has been a pleasure to talk with you. Jerry Linowska, who is a board member for the Indiana Coalition for Open Government and a Ball State University faculty member. Jerry, good to talk with you again. Always a pleasure to have you.
Thank you. Been a pleasure.
Eric Bradner, who is the State House Bureau Chief for the Evansville Courier and Press and the president of the Indiana Professional Chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists. I knew I was going to get that right once before this program was over. Eric, good to have you here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
We are going to be talking next week about the foreclosure problem here in Indiana and how it impacts people. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism and your host. Thank you for spending this time with us.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Radio 90.1 FM and HD1. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Jeanette Rhodes. Board Engineer, Matt Sosi, and Intern, Monica Schwab. We invite you to join us each Thursday at noon for No Limits, rebroadcast at 8 p.m., and you can listen online at WFYI.org.
No Limits is made by your membership and by Piano Solutions in Carmel, offering over 200 used and